I rise from the ancient tunnels of the subway, and I'm standing there on the corner of 103rd and Lex, my hometown, El Barrio USA. But now I return to bury my grandmother. Raise me up, she did. Bitter wind jostling me around, snapping at my heels, numbing cold. This is where I grew up. I'm taken aback by images of my youth. Black and white bluish TV screen flashing me scenes in that same casual style of Vietnam footage and body count graphics. People flash by, faces that you've been seeing for years and not quite knowing the name. This one looking just like your cousin Raul from 14th Street. Walking through my old neighborhood, I notice other flavors in the mix. Mexican taco stand and street, South American, brown Indian features, Africans, blue-black, selling wares next to guys who sell fruits and vianda on the street. Aguacates, yuca, tomate, malanga, yautía, guanábana. Past the new old bohíos, incongruous as they please, sitting in an empty lot surrounded by tenement buildings, backdrop of dirty brown brick. Rustic pink and blue pastel wooden shack with a tin roof and stapled on wiring. Harboring once homeless furniture. Beautiful recreation of a life that once was our reality. Little yellow and white bohíos shelter our souls. Just down the block at the bakery La Alegría, they got some serious café con leche. And some of the best bread in the world. Mommy used to send me there when I was a kid. Eguito, avanza que no se enfríe el pan. And I would walk over to the bakery taking my time, because when I got the bread fresh from the oven, I'd put it inside my coat. In its big brown paper bag, smelling so sweet, I'd always break off the end, el culito del pan, and eat it right there before I even reached the door. I'd always be so hungry after an hour's mass at St. Lucie's on 104th, where I'd sit and daydream as I listened to the beautiful acoustics of the place. It sounded like Spanish mass in the fishbowl, always trying to look interested and pious when my grandparents would glance my way. I stop in and get two loaves of fresh bread. The smell in there is pure nostalgia, simplicity. The cold slaps my face as I step out the door, chewing on the culito. I find myself hurrying to my grandmother's house, 427 East 103rd Street, apartment 3B, Puzon. Find myself realizing she's not gonna be there anymore. A little slat, sad, I slow down to look at the neighborhood and the people. I put the bread inside my coat. She was 92. That's a good long life. She would always be telling me about the young doctor who was gonna leave his wife to run off with her. Okay, maybe drive off. She had developed gout in the last couple of years, so she wasn't moving as fast. She was always kidding around and talking about sex. Before my grandfather died, and before Lala's husband, Eugenio, died, they would always joke about husband swapping. She was a kidder. Whenever I would come visit, she would always bring up the story of when I was 6 or 7 and probably not liking girls yet. I asked my grandfather, why did you marry Mami Marcela? And he asked why I asked that. And I said, because she's so ugly. I had probably been told that I couldn't eat any more candy or something. My grandfather said, I didn't have any other choice. It's all I could do. Whenever I'd visit, she'd tell me that story and laugh. I sit in the living room of the apartment I grew up in and look out the window as I dunk my buttered bread in the hot café con leche, as I watch the butter spread across the top of the coffee and try to catch the piece of bread weighted down with the sweet liquid before it falls back into the cup. I notice her plants lining the window and the other shelf my grandfather had made for them years ago. Mommy's green thumb had diminished with her health and eyesight. I remember when I was coming up, I used to marvel at how beautiful and healthy the plants all looked. Just gleaming and brilliant, and geraniums flowering and such. And now brown edges abound and dry dirt encase the collapsed crown of green holly, looking thorny. I noticed bells, something like bells, pre-recorded on tape. Amplified church bells with Doppler effects. Are the churches moving or is it me? out of tune Carrie Young, crying a French hymn Christmas song, becoming more and more bizarre. Syrupy Mr. Softy on dope. I remember being a kid 9 or 10 years old and seeing this junkie on Second Avenue. I remember because I stopped and sat on the car and watched this young man, must have been early 20s, twist and turn and shift and slide, all in this tumbling, slow motion avalanche kind of way, seemingly unable to fall down, though every earthly indicator seemed to point to that. He seemed to be on a leash. A very thin, transparent line of drool was stabilizing him and tethering him to the ground, where a slowly expanding puddle of drool was solidifying his base. I watched him for 20 minutes. It was scary and fascinating, repulsive and beautiful. It was some 3D art in the sunlight, Mr. Softy nodding, bliss illuminating his features. Bliss illuminating his plastic features. Or is that a light bulb in his head? Syrupy Mr. Softy on dope. Syrupy Mr. Softy on dope. I remember church bells and Circe. Muslim crier signaling sundown in East Harlem. Muslim crier signaling sundown in East Harlem. Muslim crier signaling sundown in East Harlem. Thank you. horse busting through the lazy afternoon, coming off the Williamsburg into Brooklyn. Massey Avenue, Hughes Street, Larimer Street, Flushing Avenue, Myrtle, Kosciuszko, Gates, Halsey Street, and Broadway. That's my stop. I walk out the door just as it rushes apart and feel the heat, blast of heat as I step into this breezeless summer night, conscious of where I am, 2.5 blocks from my home. Don't let your guard down just yet. Broadway, mostly dark and peopled only by those who tend to shun well-lit areas. 1 in 10 businesses that line this once busy thoroughfare are still in business. But as darkness advances, business recedes. Animal instinct aroused, sense of hearing, smell, eyesight, strains to sniff out a setup, a diversion. I once looked back to see a second man come out of the shadows and mug an older family man who was riding the train with me. That was before they would shoot first and go through your pockets later. Bushwick Avenue, relative safety. Much better lit, wide and long. You could see people coming for blocks and blocks. I remember Bushwick Avenue as a child going to visit my uncle, Tio Guango and Tia Mercedes before we bought the house from them. It seemed like paradise. You would walk down the avenue and there were huge maple and oak trees lining the boulevard for miles in both directions. The houses all had a little garden or shrubbery in the front yards with gates, and people were obviously proud of their houses, proud of their homes in the neighborhood. The neighborhood was changing, but I was too young to see. All I saw was a nice area and a bustling neighborhood and a sense of security, that everything would be all right. I watched that neighborhood die a slow, painful, drawn-out backslide into the muck of human despair. I watched as funds were cut from the school budget and the music class was cut from the general population to only some of the SP class. I happened to be one of the unlucky ones and wound up having biology thrust upon me in place of music. I watched as the city sent several planners, inspectors, surveyors, consultants, specialists into the neighborhood to look for new places to build affordable housing that proved to be substandard in every way except for generating huge fees for the planners, consultants, and specialists who lobbied to get their friends fly-by-night construction companies to skim the rest of the profit at the second level without even hiring anybody from the community to work on the sites. Well, maybe a few blacks and Latinos to watch the sites at night so the building materials wouldn't disappear into the night. I watched as many of these same urban renewal scams ran out of money or ran into cost overruns or were abandoned and left halfway or a third of the way or, most tragic, 80% complete, but abandoned for a lack of people who could afford affordable housing. I watched as the jobs people had known for decades left Brooklyn. There used to be breweries, Rheingold, Schaefer. There used to be manufacturing jobs, factories, warehouses, businesses. I remember when the blackout in the late 70s came. That was really the end of a few businesses who had been hardy and brave enough to still try and keep their places open in the outer boroughs. When that night came down, it was a storekeeper's penultimate nightmare, and the poor person's chance to get something for nothing now. I remember the exhilarating sense of freedom, a city gone mad. And it was just beginning to darken, and already people were pulling sofas out of showroom windows. Jewelry stores didn't even have the bust and hands that held the merchandise. That must have been taken within the first few minutes of the event. It was a long, hot summer, and people were out in force. There was a bizarre carnival-like atmosphere as people swarmed out into the sticky hot night, at first to look, and then as all the material possessions that were denied them for so long became immediately available if you were willing to cross that line. And that line blurred incomprehensibly in the first hour, let alone the whole 2 days that it took to restore order. I remember sitting up until late in the night on my stoop playing congas because nobody was sleeping. My mom was worried this might be a full-scale riot and people would want to attack anything and anybody. The man who owned the bodega next to us came back to his store with his cousin and brother-in-law and a shotgun and 2 pistols, parked the station wagon in front of the store and hunkered down for the duration. It turns out he was one of the few businessmen people could identify with. So he opened up and probably did incredible business that night, because looting works up a ferocious thirst. I could not believe the things I saw that night. A well-dressed man pushing a shopping cart full of meat, shards of glass still dotting the topmost rack of pork ribs. My friend Nestor came running by, his arms filled with toys and stuffed animals, 5 or 6 cheap gold chains around his neck. He runs up to my gate, jumps over the fence, and hands me a pair of bongos. "These are for you, Eddie." Winks and is lost in the night again. It seemed to take him just 20 or 25 strides to make it from my house to his, halfway down Covert Street. I was dumbstruck. I hadn't even moved from my doorstep, and I was now holding a pair of brand new bongos. So I took them out of the box, tuned them up, and started to serenade this world gone mad. Fire trucks blared in the distance. The bicycle shop, which was catty corner from us, got hit around 10 or 11 that night. The white guy who owned it seemed to want to stay, but decided he better get the fuck out while he could. He left his dog, a huge German shepherd who'd always scared me from even walking too close to the store. I watched them played as I saw 2 young black men come in and using some huge metal cutter, just snipped the lock off the gate and opened the store. Apparently they knew the dog was in there, because when one opened the basement door, the other stood poised with a trash can. As the door opened and the big dog leapt out at them, the second youth hit that dog so hard, it went into a conniption and laid down and died on the spot. The dog had leapt straight up into the air 3 or 4 feet and had been laid waste in one fell swoop. Bang! That motherfucker was quivering and shaking on the ground. It was a pitiful sight. After that initial opening, the neighborhood toughs came and cleaned out the store in less than 10 minutes. The only cops I saw that night came by just when some kid who must have been 13 or 14 walked by with 2 of his friends, saw the bike shop open, and stepped inside. When the squad car pulled up, sirens blaring, shining its light directly onto the front, the 2 friends busted out of there like their lives depended on it, which it probably did. The last boy ran right out into the arms of John Law. I didn't see too much, but the cops let him know that he shouldn't have been there. If it weren't so tragic, it would have been hilarious. Back to reality now. That was me trying to be seamless. Of course, I left my stuff back here, so I have to walk back. So much for seamlessness. on with our adventure. Sid was an old man in Brooklyn I knew when I was growing up in Bushwick. An updated African village in the middle of a sprawling ghetto that was once a very pleasant working class neighborhood. Till there weren't any jobs left and despair took on a full-time status. Sid, aside from being a grandfather, homeowner, former or recovering winehead, and weekend bootlegger, providing Sunday services for a mostly devout flock of black sheep. And not a bad conga player either. He taught me a lot about the conga and the history. He was the first one to tell me about how conga players in the old days just played one drum, which while seeming on the surface as a limiting thing, actually opened up a lot of possibilities. Puzzle. My mom thought I was crazy when I was a kid because I'd rummage around in the basement of our house on Bushwick looking through 30 years worth of old music. She couldn't understand why I'd come upstairs with the old Tito Rodriguez at the Palladium Records and blast them on the stereo. I learned so much from those relics that were forgotten in our cellar. I would talk with Sid about those records and his face would light up. You know, I was there in the Palladium when Tito recorded that album. And one of the best records of all was a battle of the bands between the two Titos, Tito Rodriguez and Tito Puente. Now that was something. People dressed so fine and the dancing that went on there was out of this world, crazy. We would go to the local playground around sundown after supper with his big family and sit down and get nice. He'd have a little taste of wine. I'd smoke a little pot if I had some. And we'd discuss the world over the congas and we'd play till 9 or 10 and watch as people would come out of their houses and come sit with us to listen. He was a master of that particularly 50s style of playing that was all about masacote, or sort of the small, almost invisible motions and patterns that make up a really solid tumbao rhythm. Solid, solid, and take your time when you, where you running with that beat, boy? Like Mongo, he used to say. Sit in the groove and let it carry you. Don't run ahead like some crazy man. Much later, I realized how profound a lesson, how important magic is to a rhythm. Thank you. Thank you again all for coming down. I saw firsthand how nasty it is outside. It was nicer earlier in the day when I was just carrying shit. Thank you all for coming down. So I've lost my place in those of you with the program, where I'm at?
Cheese! Cheese!
That's sort of a shorthand. Those of you who know me, just
cheese!
Life in Brooklyn, Bushwick, somehow reminded me of those Channel 13 documentaries about village life. Groups of black and brown babies playing in the street. The faces were the same. The only difference was the urban landscape. And in those days, in the outback of Brooklyn, in the summer, big heat waves rising off the pavement, distorting your vision as you looked across a rubble-strewn lot, overgrown with weeds and tall grasses, reminded me of the savannah. Young predators out to survive, sometimes hunting in packs. You become very aware of never ever showing you're scared, trying to look as mean and dangerous as you can. And some of the youngsters can look and be very mean indeed. I remember once I was about 7 or 8 and this older kid had a gang. He must have been 10 or so, but he was the leader and he was walking up and down with his boys, looking tough, walking up and down. But he was eating a piece of cheese. Kraft American individually wrapped slices. And maybe memory is playing tricks on me, but I could have sworn his face bore some very rat-like features. It must be true, because I would have never been so careless as to let myself be caught laughing at the sight of a person acting tough and eating cheese. Yeah, it must have been the added dimension of this fearsome creature resembling a rodent and eating cheese that brought on an unconscious smile to my lips, like the last 3 bubbles on a week-old Pepsi in the fridge. But there I was, busted by the last individual I even wanted to see, let alone have to answer questions to. So what you looking at, punk? What are you laughing at? You see something funny? He was still eating cheese. I never went out of the house without my grandmother. I could have used her then. As a matter of fact, I was still standing on my stoop when they came by. I guess I still hadn't worked out the finer points of lying, because it just rolled out of my mouth with the greatest of ease. You're eating cheese and acting tough. They don't go together. But the second the last word had cleared my lips, I immediately knew I shouldn't have said that. I probably could have made up a better lie to answer, but maybe not. I was pretty inexperienced at that point. I saw this larger boy than myself first laugh, then stop and look at me like the most ignorant little cousin you ever had, then start to go through some serious hue changes before throwing down the last bit of cheese and flying up the stairs to grab me by the lapels and start shaking me and yelling as loud as he could right in my face. The cheese breath was horrifying. Needless to say, I was scared. I didn't know what to say or how. I was being choked by then. I didn't know what to do when I think by accident, a real knee-jerk reaction. I must have kneed him in the nuts. And some animal was awakening me just as he let go and was trying to catch his breath. I began choking him and having him backwards over this concrete division between my stoop and the one next door. I took that opportunity to add a slight variation and started banging the kid's head into the concrete divider. I was in a blind rage, but Somewhere in the back of my head, I heard the other kids starting to cheer. Then some much older kids, 16 or so, came by and separated us. Now the older boy who ate cheese and acted tough was on my stoop, sitting on the ground, with the older boy asking him if he was okay. I just walked down my steps to get away from that other boy and clear my head. My heart was going a mile a minute, and it tasted like gunpowder in my mouth. And I was still scared. I walked down the steps into his crowd, and they did a very strange thing. They picked me up on their shoulders. At first, I thought they were going to carry me over to the avenue and throw me into traffic. But then I saw they were really happy and were carrying me like I was some kind of hero, bouncing me up and down all the way to the far corner and back to my stoop, where they left me and said, if anybody ever mess with me, to let them know, and the whole gang will fight for me. They said I was in the gang. I was the gang mascot since I was too young to be in the gang itself. After that, I was in 3 gang fights, providing support materials, bringing more Coke bottles to throw at the black kids from 100th Street. They would throw knee-high bottles and big gallon jugs of wine that reminded me of a shotgun blast in this wider swath. Yeah, I was in 3 gang fights, which in those days of innocence mainly dealt with bottle throwing and cursing. Till one day, while we were fighting the black kids from 100th Street, some Italians from 108th Street started shooting BB guns at us from the roof of our own block. So we were stuck in the crossfire, bottles and BB guns. Those were the days. I remember I was right next to my friend Papa, who broke up that first fight when he got shot right in the thumb. It was very shocking to realize you were being fired upon on your own block. It must have hurt like a bitch. I could see the pellet stuck in his thumb, right behind his fingernail. Then I felt pip, pip, pip when I ran behind the car to get more bottles. They hit me, but my jacket with all those patches on the back, with all the Major League Baseball teams, they had hit 3 times on one of the heavy patches, and they hadn't gone through. California Angels. I think the Angels saved me. Thanks. Thank you. a few months ago, a very cool drummer passed away. He was a bit older, but I've admired him very much. And as much as I can, I tried to learn from him as much as I could. And he was a really sweet guy, as well as being an amazing player. And so this is for him, this is for Ed Blackwell, who passed earlier in this year. Okay. Thank you. not looking directly at you, but you know, I'm still talking. Can, y'all. We have the can. This is my can. In case those of you who haven't seen it before, it's a milk can. Grandview Farms. They don't make them anymore. You can't have mine. This is a baby can. It's a smaller version. As you can see, this one's a bully.
Thank you.
have come to the end of the show. Does anybody have any more rum? No? Stomu Takeshi. Stomu Takeshi, electric bass, a musical foundation. Chris Cunningham, guitars, electric, acoustic, and stick, and percussion. I'm EJ Rodriguez. I bothered you most of the time. Thank you.